the design thinking, the collaboration, the coordination, the engineering, the architecture for adaptive reuse, it can be a bit different. And I think one of the things that we really need to think carefully about is how we educate our future generation to be able to deliver these types of solutions.
Kia ora, I'm Troy, here as Chief Executive, and welcome to Stirring the Pot. Thanks for connecting. If you're new, here's what you can expect. We're going to be talking the tough stuff, the things that keep us middle minds up at night. There are many challenges facing our industry and equally many opinions on how we should tackle them. Stirring the Pot provides a facilitated forum to discuss and challenge these viewpoints.
So let's get to the nuts and bolts of it. Today, our kōrero is with Neil Horsfield, who is Beckers General Manager, Global Building Structures. Join us as we chat about the potential for adaptive reuse of our building stock.
Can you tell me a bit about yourself and your role at Becker?
Sure. So I was actually born in the UK in a town called Rochdale, which is on the outskirts of Manchester. And I grew up in South Wales. My parents moved to South Wales, where I grew up. I studied civil engineering at the University of Wales in Swansea. And when I graduated, I started working for a large international consultancy in Cardiff. After about 4 years, I had an opportunity to go to Hong Kong with that firm, and I worked in Hong Kong for 10 years as a structural engineer, and worked on a range of projects, quite large projects in Hong Kong, as you could imagine. It was in the run-up to the handover from the British rule to handing over to the Chinese rule, and that was in 1997. So I saw that transition. And then I, after 10 years, was looking for something a little bit different. And so started looking around the world at where I might go next. I'd actually met my wife in Hong Kong by that time. And so we decided we'd like to relocate to New Zealand. And we'd been here a few times on holiday. And so we really relocated here. And I came to New Zealand in 2004 and joined Becker. I'll talk a little bit more about Becker in a minute. Interesting, when I lived in Hong Kong, we lived in a 42-story tower block on the south side of Hong Kong Island. There's a little island off the fishing town, or fishing village there, called Aptay Chow. And at the time, and it may well still be, I think it was the most densely populated island in the world. So a lot of very tall tower blocks. I didn't really get an opportunity to do a lot of DIY living in that sort of environment. But when I came to New Zealand, did start to get that opportunity. We bought a house in Titirangi, and we did some refurbishment and renovation there. And then in 2010, we were visiting some friends that lived out at the Kaipara Harbour, and we saw a large-ish villa that had been relocated from Remuera to the Kaipara Harbour area. It had been cut up into five pieces, moved out there and reassembled. So that was kind of my first real attempt at adaptive reuse, you might say, which we're going to talk about a bit later. I spent about 7 years working on that project, and we turned it from what was pretty derelict into a very nice home, and then sold that in 2017. And now I live in the city on the fringe of the city, within walking distance of our office, in a residential apartment building that was refurbished, was constructed in the 1980s and refurbished about 8 years ago. So sort of swung into quite a different lifestyle. So my role at Becker, I joined Becker in 2004, as I said, and joined as a structural engineer, and I was working on local projects, but I also got involved quite heavily in working on delivering projects in Asia, where we have quite a bit of business and operations through Asia. And spent quite a bit of time in my early years at Becker traveling to Indonesia and working on some quite large commercial projects there for a range of clients. I became section manager of the Auckland team here in Auckland in 2007 or six, and I've sort of carried that through in terms of management position. So my role now is I'm general manager of the structures business. Becker, as you may know, is a large multidisciplinary firm, one of the largest professional services firms in the Asia Pacific region. We employ around 4,000 people. About three quarters of those are in New Zealand, a quarter in Australia, and a quarter through Australia, and about a quarter in Southeast Asia. I'm providing professional services across a range of markets to a range of clients through transport infrastructure, industrial advisory services, sustainability consulting, and of course utilities and power, and of course buildings. So my role as general manager of the structures business line sees me responsible for around about 450 structural engineers through New Zealand and across the Southeast Asia region.
Mm-hmm. So, Becker, at our Future Forum Industry Awards this year, the 2023 awards, was recognised for its work on adaptive reuse of the cab building. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a bit more about that project?
Yes. Yeah. So the cab is an interesting building and also has a long history and interesting story. Probably I'd take that story back to 1907, believe it or not. Tibor Donner, who was the architect for that project, was born in 1907. He was born in Hungary, raised in Romania. And I think in 1927, he would have been 21. Him and his family emigrated to New Zealand. They were looking to escape from post-war Europe at that time. He came to New Zealand, to Auckland, and studied architecture at what is now the University of Auckland. He was a very bright student and became an architect and got involved in quite a number of reasonably significant projects, some of which are still around today. And he eventually joined Auckland City Council at that time, and became the chief architect of Auckland City Council in 1947. And he started to look at schemes for the civic area that's Aotea Square in Auckland, which had been going through a number of considerations of options over a long time, and they couldn't land on a solution. But Auckland City Council was growing, and it needed more accommodation. And he developed a scheme that ultimately retained the civic theatre and the town hall. You can imagine what some of the schemes involved in the demolition and removal of those buildings, which are now sort of heritage buildings on the Auckland landscape. It's almost unfathomable that would be considered. And so he developed a scheme for the square that retained those buildings, which was what we see the cab today. But he did a lot of research, and one of the things he was interested in was doing something that didn't follow the Second World War post-war British kind of brutalist style. And he wanted to do something more in the American style. And so he decided to go on a study tour of North America with a colleague of his, a structural engineer at Auckland City Council called Vern Coleman, I think his name was. And in 1956, him, Tibor Donner and Vern Coleman traveled to North America on this study tour, and they'd planned to visit the, or go to the first World Earthquake Conference in San Francisco, where they'd planned to meet an engineer by the name of John Bloom, who had studied at Stanford University and was very much at the forefront of seismic engineering. And they collaborated with, or they would have collaborated with John Bloom at that time, and then John Bloom was appointed as the structural engineer for the CAB. And they developed this scheme that was in this sort of American style, which is what we see today, which is the steel moment frame system that John Bloom designed, which would have been quite groundbreaking at the time. It's a very slender structure, but a very well detailed and documented structure, which I'll talk about as well perhaps later. And so they came together and they designed the building that we see today, and the construction was completed in 1966, which is significant for me because that was the year I was born. So that's a little bit of the history. I can talk a little bit more about what happens later, if you like. So the building is then sort of occupied by Auckland City Council for many years. In the late 1980s, they had to vacate the building to remove asbestos and things that were used at that time to provide fire protection and that sort of thing. So those are some of the things that were being incorporated into buildings then that obviously we wouldn't do today. And then over a period of time, the building sort of was no longer really fit for purpose for Auckland City Council, and eventually was abandoned and in terms of a building that was being used, and Auckland Council sold, were looking to sell the building, and they sold the building to John Love and Josie Love, and they, their company Love & Co, set up a company to redevelop the CAB into apartment buildings. And so we started talking with John and Josie probably in the middle of the teens, around the sort of 2015, 2016 time, about how we could look to repurpose the CAB into apartment buildings and how we might go about doing that.
And so what are the environmental outcomes of adaptive reuse, and what role does the structural steel play in that?
Well, maybe I'll carry the story on a little bit with the CAB, actually. So one of the considerations for the CAB was, how do we preserve some of the heritage? So you can imagine the story I've just told, there's quite a bit of heritage that sits in there, not just in the fabric of the building, but also in the technology that was employed in creating it. And so a big part of that was the engineering story and the part that John Bloom and the engineering, the seismic engineering that had been brought in, and retaining that heritage, not necessarily in the steel, I mean, the steel's the steel, but in the technology that was employed in connecting the steel together, creating this steel moment frame. So that was important. There were heritage elements. The staircases were, the escape staircases were very beautifully detailed with terrazzo finishes and forged balustradings and things like that. And so there were other things. There was the facade, which was a bit controversial, but was one of the first types of aluminium facade systems of that type that had been built in New Zealand. So that had some heritage quality as well, and sunshading devices. Some of these things just weren't serviceable. They couldn't really be retained but some of them could. So we had to sort of start picking through that, working out how we could retain these things. So part of your question, perhaps an answer, is around sort of retaining some of those cultural values and heritage values in what might not obviously be a sort of heritage sort of building. You think of heritage buildings, perhaps sort of stone and that sort of thing, but this is a sort of relatively modern heritage building. So we really were compelled to retain the steel frame, and we were compelled to retain the steel staircase. We had to look at how we could then incorporate those into the structure. So one of the challenges we face there, of course, is that it's often more difficult to, from an engineering and an architectural perspective, to then work with the raw material that you have, because you have these constraints to work with. So, you know, the engineering element is quite complex. We have to undertake a detailed seismic assessment of the building to demonstrate that it has got a sufficient amount of seismic resilience. We did a detailed seismic assessment. We had to work with the architect to understand how the architectural planning would work with the framing arrangement that we had to reconfigure lifts. But one of the real challenges we had was, whilst the steel frame was very robust, we were able to test its robustness and resilience using advanced analytical techniques. But the floor system that was used at the time, which was it was called QDEC, a metal tray, a little bit like sort of composite floor systems that you see today, with a screed topping, which didn't have any reinforcement in it. It was just a screed topping on this metal tray. And some of the concrete in the metal tray was delaminating, and you know, when we started to investigate this, the floor system wasn't really serviceable. So we had to remove it. So that was quite complicated. We had to work quite closely with the construction team at Naylor Love to work out how we could remove the floor in a sequence and then reconstruct the floor and work through what was the right material to use to reconstruct the floor. And what that led to was, for a number of reasons, but that led to a top-down sort of construction approach. So I mentioned asbestos earlier. There was still asbestos in the building. That had to be meticulously removed. And it was, and Naylor Love and the team worked very hard on that, and they were able to start from the top and remove the asbestos from the top down. Naturally enough, you want to be bringing that material through the building, not through the clean building top up. That just wouldn't work logistically. And then, of course, the follow-on trades followed on after that. So asbestos removed, then floors being removed over a series of four or five levels, and then new floors being constructed from top down, facade sort of top down as well. So quite a sort of complicated approach to analysis. We had to be confident that by removing floors we weren't creating instabilities in the building, so that had to be checked as well. So yeah, quite a complicated approach. So you know, the challenges that you face with adaptive reuse could be quite significant and require quite a lot of collaboration, engineering consideration, coordination, and planning.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that a lot of the constraints of this particular project would have been, I wouldn't say intimidating, but maybe a bit daunting in the process. But then that connection to the past, I guess, and honouring, you know, the future of the building and that connection to the past. Was that something that's quite unusual in the projects that you do? How did you find that? Was that exciting and fun, or did it make you think about how buildings are designed You know, when you're thinking about the original designer and the building now, that kind of experience, did it change the way that you think about your role with the future of buildings and, you know, someone in the future having to do something similar with one of your own buildings?
I found it fascinating. As you might be able to tell, I've enjoyed understanding the history of the building and discovering that. One of the things that I think really helped us was how meticulously the building design was documented. Not using BIM models or computer models or Revit or any digital technology of any kind, but meticulously documented by hand, and really, really well archived. And we were able to go to the library and find information, and there was the archives were excellent, and there'd been a lot of research done already by the heritage architects looking at the history, and that informed some of the decisions. But that meticulous documentation, I think there's probably something there that we can learn, because thinking about or understanding what you've got to work with is quite difficult initially, because you can't get in. We couldn't get in and look at the building too closely because of the asbestos, for example. So we had to work with what we had in terms of the documentation and do that sort of work desktop style. So I think if we think about the future, then how we document our buildings, how we model them, how we create that inventory of information, we're sort of now getting to a situation where we can model things, the creation of digital twins, and really sort of have a representation of the physical world in this digital world. I think, you know, those are the sorts of things and the technologies that are going to really help us in the future. That's something that I really found quite fascinating, and I think does sort of inform my thinking into the future in terms of how we should think about how we document that sort of physical world.
Leads in well to HERA's Construction 4.0 project, and a project that we're working on where we will be starting to facilitate buildings to be considered a bank of materials, which is our material passport project. So in terms of the carbon benefits of adaptive reuse, what was your finding through this project?
So obviously we wanted to understand what sort of impact we've made in terms of embodied carbon. I'd say that probably there weren't the principal drivers around what we were doing. I think, as I've mentioned, the heritage was one of those principal drivers. But certainly it was important for us to understand what sort of impact the project has made from an embodied carbon perspective. So we've done some analysis of that, and I think it's been reported that the estimated savings in terms of embodied carbon from the reuse of the steel frame was around 6,000 tons of carbon dioxide. And so that sounds like a lot of 6,000 tons of anything sounds like a lot. You've got to sort of put that into context. I think if you start to put that into context, 6,000 tons of carbon dioxide equivalent is approximately around 10 hours of full capacity operation Huntly Power Station. And then you think, 10 hours doesn't sound like all that much, but I think that's a good statistic, because it gives you a sort of sense of the scale of the issue that we face. If you break that down, though, and put it into the context of the building itself, and in that context, you start to see a bit more significance, I think, because 6,000 tons of carbon exceeds the operational carbon for the building through its life. It's a residential building, so the carbon, the operational carbon is relatively low. But even so, you've got a building now that there's been an embodied carbon saving that that exceeds the operational carbon by some margin, actually. Another way to think about it is that it might be the equivalent of 2,500 cars off the road for a year. I think those numbers are right. Somebody will probably verify them and tell me if they're not. But 2,500 cars, one. I think that works out about one car for every dwelling in the building for the next 25 years. You know, so when you start looking at the building itself and how it stacks up in itself, and I think, you know, there's quite a compelling story there. And of course, it's in the center of town, so those people that have those cars, they probably wouldn't use them very much anyway, because they'd be walking to work.
So, I mean, obviously, when you put it as 10 hours of Huntley, it doesn't sound very much, but when you talk about 2,500 cars off the road, it makes more sense. But yes, you're right. That is quite a sobering idea that 2,500 cars is 10 hours of Huntley time. So how do we go about, thinking about things differently in terms of, you know, modules A, B, C, and D? So the module A tends to get a lot of the focus around embodied carbon, but C and D, we don't really talk a lot about end of life, reuse of materials, and if we do, we're probably talking more about recycling rather than reuse or repurposing. What are the advantages that you see around looking at things more holistically? It might include, for example, designing for circularity. What do you think are the issues and, I guess, the potential promises?
That's a really good question, Troy. You mentioned that the focus is on module A in terms of embodied carbon. I think that's right, because I sort of think of, I have an analogy of this. If we think about, perhaps we're sitting on the equator of the Earth, and we want to get to the North Pole, and we want to get there before the ice cap melts. So we've got to head due north because we need to get there quickly, and we can't afford to sort of meander our way there. So how do we get there quickly? We've got to deal with the things that we understand today, and we've got to get on with it. And so we understand the production of materials, and we understand, we think we do. Well, we understand. We certainly understand those because they're here in the present and now. So we can start to measure those, modify our behaviors, modify our decisions and our thinking, and deal with those things now. That's not to say we shouldn't be thinking about the future too, but, you know, there's an urgency. When we start, I probably should just sort of maybe just quickly talk about modules A, B, C, and D so people sort of understand what we're talking about there. Sort of module A is the, we're talking about the life cycle of an asset in terms of its carbon, in terms of both embodied carbon and operational carbon. So that's the carbon that's generated through the production of the asset, and then the carbon that's generated through the operation of the asset through its lifetime, and the carbon that's then created in terms of disposing of the asset. And we call those are sort of modules A, which is the creation of the asset and handing it over. And module B is the operational, and module C is the decommissioning of the asset. And we call that the sort of cradle to grave. And module D is sort of like beyond the grave, and what we do with the benefits and sort of liabilities that accrue from the material that then is left over that needs to be recycled. So, as I say, dealing with those, with the things that we can see in front of us right now, I think is important, but also building in some thinking around design for the future beyond the end use of that particular asset. And if you to go back to the cab, you know, the cab, if if there was such a thing as that modular thinking in terms of embodied carbon back in the 1960s, you would very much say that where we were at when we started, that was kind of module D. You know, we were looking at how we could, the building had come to its end, the end of its useful life in its form, and we were looking to how we could reuse those materials, and so the steel frame very much was that, and you could say maybe John Bloom and Tibor Donner at the time were thinking about that, maybe not, but the steel frame that we worked with was an open steel moment frame, and made it very, so it was quite difficult, as I mentioned, but still very easy in terms of easier in terms of the planning. If it had had shear walls and cross braces and all sorts of things, it would have been a bit more difficult, perhaps. But the counter to that is, that was 60 years ago, and technology has changed an awful lot in that time. And so if we project forward from here, 50, 60 years, we don't really know what technology is going to be at our disposal at that time. So we should have an eye on that in terms of design. I don't think we should necessarily let those design decisions overly dictate the decisions we make now that are dealing with the things that we have to deal with in the very present future. So, I think perhaps there's an objective piece now and a more subjective view for that module D thinking.
Mm. Yeah, I think definitely there needs to be more research around and more evidence to make reliable assessments around modules C and D. But I do think that even in our conversations, we need to be talking about them not being mutually exclusive, that we should be keeping one eye to the future and not transferring the problem to our children in 50 years' time. Yes, I think that's the critical thing, isn't it? We've got an urgency to remove carbon from the built environment now, but at the same time, we want to make sure we're not just passing that on to our children as a problem for them. What are the other advantages of adaptive reuse? Did you find anything else other than environmental and heritage benefits?
I've talked about some of the learning. So developing skills is something that I think that we've seen. I think just sort of thinking a little bit about how we go about effecting that, effecting adaptive reuse. I think that it's probably fairly sensible to imagine that we just can't keep demolishing existing buildings and creating new ones. There's an awful lot of building stock that we have to deal with. And so, you know, we do need to develop methods and technologies using the skills that we are learning to be able to think about ways in which we can sort of avoid this approach of removing and creating new. One of the things we do need to think carefully about, I think, is how we build resilience into our adaptive reuse thinking. That's quite challenging, because I think you'll be aware that there's a lot of need to improve the building stock in New Zealand, particularly. So, looking at seismic resilience is an area that requires quite a lot of attention. We've got a lot of potentially earthquake-prone buildings in New Zealand that need to be upgraded and improved or removed. That's a challenge. There's a challenge there around undertaking seismic strengthening improvements that don't just detract from value. So thinking about how we can incentivize, how we can create economic value. What are the drivers that can promote seismic upgrades and building in that resilience? If you think back to the Christchurch earthquakes, 2010, 2011, apart from some notable exceptions, buildings tended to perform reasonably well from a life safety perspective, but we ended up with a situation where, because there was a lack of resilience in the building stock, and because of the insurance provisions at the time, a lot of the central business district, for example, I think we lost about 80% of the central business district. So we need to move on from there and look at how we can build resilience into buildings. So designing new buildings, we can do that more readily. But how do we do that in terms of a retrofit situation is more complicated. We've got a really good example, actually, of a building in Wellington where we've undertaken an adaptive retrofit. It's a building called 8 Willis Street in the centre of Wellington. And that was a building that was originally 8 stories tall. It was a reinforced concrete moment frame building. Its seismic resilience was not at a standard or a level that the client wanted. But they wanted to both increase the height and size of that building and improve its seismic resilience to significantly greater than what was required under the current standard, the new building standard, because they wanted some element of future-proofing, because standards change, as we learn. And so we came up with a solution there which involved installing fluid viscous dampers, which is quite a innovative technology. Well, fluid viscous dampers have been around for a long time, but how we incorporate these into the building is quite innovative. We were able to undertake quite an extensive analysis to understand where is the best place to put them for most effective use. So rather than distributing them over the full building, we can selectively locate them. And so using that technology, we're able to increase the height of that building from 8 stories to 13 stories and almost double the footprint with no significant alterations to the foundations. So that's and the seismic performance of that building, we've designed it to be 130% of new building standard to provide that element of future proofing. So you could see the sort of engineering required is sort of significantly more it's more advanced perhaps, but it's more intense. You know, there's a higher level of intensity in that engineering and knowledge that's required.
I think one of the aspects of adaptive reuse that really captures my imagination is exposing the good bones of the building and the strong architecture that underpins a lot of the design that gets tucked away and never really seen or understood until, you know, the skin is pared away. We had one of our founders of HERA, Cyril Baker, come in and he had a beautiful black and white photographic album of many buildings originally built in Auckland area with the steel frames. And it was really beautiful just seeing the design of the bones of those buildings. I think, to me it's something inspiring, I guess, from a professional perspective around, you know, the importance of anticipating the lifetimes of a building. And I think it's also really, I guess, romantic when you're looking back at, you know, these people who designed a building at one point in time and then seeing how it's being reused again. It must be a very, I think it would be such a rewarding experience for those people to know how this building is enduring, has, you know, moved with the times and being used in different ways. And I wonder if, as you said earlier, you know, those technologies, if we can deploy those in advance to actually deliberately anticipate reuse of buildings. You know, there's a lot of fulfillment professionally that people can have around designing for enduring application of these designs. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or anything you wanted to circle back? You did mention a few times that you would come back to some ideas.
I think I probably managed to cover most of those along the way. One of the things I did want to touch on, and I probably emphasize this quite a bit, is this idea that the thinking, the design thinking, the collaboration, the coordination, the engineering, the architecture for adaptive reuse it can be a bit different. And I think one of the things that we really need to think carefully about is how we educate our future generation to be able to deliver these types of solutions. I know that when I went through university, there was nothing in my engineering degree that really talked around how we could adaptively reuse structures that had been designed before. You know, we were learning about the principles of engineering, and they're all still very valid, and architects will be doing the same. But there's a different discipline that's required. And so, you know, if we're going to scale this use of existing buildings so we can, you know, sort of address the Huntley Power Station scenario more effectively, then we really need to think about how we educate our people. And not just engineers and architects, but the decision makers, you know, the people that are setting policy and the politicians. There's a whole generation of people, I think, that need to be educated into this way of thinking.
Yeah, agree. We should really be seeing our building stock as that bank of materials that can be reused, and eventually, basically the whole concept should be that it's just a refit or a refurb with minor changes. It's always grating to me when we talk about the building code and the lifespan within the building code, and yet we know our materials and we know our designs can endure, you know, probably orders of magnitude at least, and many, many, many multiples of those 50-year timeframes. So why aren't we thinking about that? It would be great to see, for example, at university level, people being given a BIM model for, you know, a building that they admire and saying, okay, this is your client's requirements. How would you go about adaptive reuse in this building, and what would happen? That would be an amazing training program. Okay, anything else that you want to cover?
Yes, I hope that John Bloom and Tibor Donner would be very satisfied to see that the building that they designed 60 years ago is enduring today. I should also sort of just acknowledge some of the, it's a team effort when you pull these projects together, so I should just acknowledge the work that JazzMax and Andy Anderson, that led the JazzMax team, did in terms of the architectural planning, and the work that that Naylor Love did in terms of the construction planning, which was, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a very challenging project. Obviously, my colleagues at Becker and John and Josie Love, who are the developers, who had the vision to sort of see the opportunity.
So there you go. Thanks for joining our conversation with Neil today. If you'd like to connect more with him, you'll find his details in the show notes. We'd just like to congratulate Becker for being awarded the Innovate Taiao Industry Award, which was presented at our Future Forum Nation Dinner sponsored by New Zealand Steel. This project is a great example of how structural designers and engineers can reduce embodied carbon by reusing the materials within a building to give it a new lease of life. After all, if we don't consider life cycle carbon now, we are deferring the carbon problem for our future generations. Food for thought till we see you next time. So hit subscribe, and if you like what you heard today, please like, review, or share with any Metal Minds you know. Let's spread the word. If you like what you heard today, you might be interested to know more about HERA's work in the sustainability space. In particular, our works to develop a steel circularity materials passport in an effort to better facilitate structural steel reuse. This will be the first material passport in the Australasian construction sector of its kind, and will serve as a proof of concept to significantly assist the New Zealand construction sector to develop material passport capability for other building components and materials. To find out more, you can find details in the show notes.